Good morning. Richard Lechick on behalf of the appellant, Margaret Colson. I'll reserve 3 minutes. For over a century in both civil and criminal cases, Washington appellate courts have applied the law of the case doctrine. Under this doctrine, the state bears the burden of proving any added requirements contained in the jury instructions. Here, the jury instructions contain added requirements as to principal liability and the date of the offenses. Because the state did not meet its burden to prove these added requirements, all the convictions for identity theft should be reversed.
Well, how do you calculate State v. Tyler and
Musashio. So Musashio is the case that interpreted the Fifth Amendment due process clause, and it interpreted federal common law, and it held that under those provisions, federal courts don't analyze sufficiency of the evidence claims against the jury instructions. Since that was a federal issue, it has nothing to say about Washington common law. It has nothing to say about Washington's interpretation of its constitution and its rules on appeal. So this court, regardless of what it thinks about, you know, the policy or the rationale of Musashio, this court is bound to continue to apply Hickman, which has held that the law of the case doctrine has existed in Washington for over a century. It's a doctrine that's not based on due process. It's based on the common law. It's applied in both civil and criminal cases. Now, when we analyze whether the state's met its burden, Washington has adopted the sufficiency of the evidence analysis, which was created by the U.S. Supreme Court in Jackson versus Virginia and in Winship. And so those constitutional principles don't mean that the law of the case doctrine no longer exists anymore once the Supreme Court has interpreted those otherwise. So I think this court is bound to apply Hickman until the Washington Supreme Court has said otherwise. It's accepted review in Johnson, which was the first case, departing from thinking that Musashio was binding. I think that's because the Supreme Court recognizes that it's up to its role to determine whether that case has to be overruled or not.
If the law of the case doctrine doesn't have any constitutional underpinnings, then isn't it subject to great discretion by the judiciary on how to apply it, when to apply it? We've adopted RAP 2.5 that takes major limitations on the common law of the case doctrine.
Well, I think this court is bound until the Supreme Court says otherwise. It has to keep applying Hickman and that policy justification would have to be done by them. That would be my answer to that question.
How about State v. McKeekow from Division II case?
So I think that case, they declined to analyze.
They did, but what they did do is said because the alleged alternatives were phrased in the disjunctive, that all they had to do was to, if the evidence satisfied one of those.
And that issue goes to my claim as to the mail, theft of mail. Count. That doesn't affect at all my analysis on the convictions as to identity theft. And as to the convictions to identity theft, the analysis is the two-convict instruction for count 7 contained the language in element 4, the defendant or an accomplice. Now, all the other elements and all the other two-convict instructions, including that one, too, said the defendant. A jury looking at these instructions, reading the instructions as a whole, would conclude, well, the state has to prove that the defendant, Ms. Colson, committed each element, and only on this other one do we get an issue of accomplice liability.
Why do we assume that the jury ignored the general accomplice instruction that was given? Why should we assume that?
It doesn't ignore it. It uses that instruction in conjunction with instruction 7, where it says the defendant or an accomplice. And the case I direct Your Honor to is State versus Willis. And in that case, a two-convict instruction said the defendant or an accomplice, and there's a general accomplice liability instruction like in this one. But the firearm enhancement instruction contained the language just you must find the defendant was armed with a firearm. It didn't say the defendant or an accomplice. And the Supreme Court said the state bears the burden of proving that the defendant, not an accomplice, was armed with a firearm. So that case is analogous to what we have here, and the state's not said nothing about that case, impliedly conceding that that's the analysis this court should follow. Applying that analysis, the state was obligated to prove that Ms. Colson committed every element, excluding element 4 and count 7, as a principal. The state did not meet its burden to do so. The state proved, at best, that she was complicit in these acts and proved accomplice liability, but did not prove that she committed the offenses as a principal. So all the convictions should be reversed under the law of the case doctrine. I've made a separate claim as to count 1 and 2, which regard the dates, and that also goes to the law of the case issue when all the language in a to convict instruction has to be proven. So the state undertook the burden to prove that these offenses were committed on or about a certain date. The state doesn't get to change its theory for the first time in appeal that, oh, well, actually these offenses were committed 10 days earlier or some other time. They elected that date.
Didn't they elect on or about?
They did elect, that's the charging language. And during closing argument, the state elected, said, we've proven the date of the crime, February 16th. That's the date the officers pulled her over. We've proven it. So they told the jury that's the date to look at. And I've cited a case where the state doesn't get to change its theory on appeal. There was a Division II case where the state argued they just had to prove about. And they tried to say, well, we didn't have to prove he was armed with a firearm on this date, you know, like we argued at trial. We just have to prove about. And the Court of Appeals rejected that argument. So I'll come back on a rebuttal.
All right, you have 3 minutes.
May it please the Court, Ann Summers on behalf of the State of Washington. I wish to first address the alternative means analysis as to possession of stolen mail, and then I'll turn to the sufficiency challenge to the identity theft convictions based on law of the case doctrine. Possession of stolen mail is a single means crime because the terms at issue, receive, retain, possess, conceal, or dispose of, are all minor nuances or facets of the same conduct. The Supreme Court recently in Owens and Sandholm and Lindsay, I think, has finally given us a workable rubric from which to evaluate whether terms within a statute are actually alternative means or just definitional terms. And the question and the focus is on the distinctness of the conduct that those terms describe. If the terms are not sufficiently distinct, then they are not alternative means. The terms here at issue are very similar to the terms that were at issue in Owens, which is trafficking, Macacao, which is possession of stolen vehicle, and Tyler, which is possession of stolen vehicle. And in all those cases, the similar terms were held by those courts to be minor nuances of the same conduct. The same here. These are all minor nuances of possession. And therefore, you can see the substantial conceptual overlap between these terms. These verbs, it demonstrates there's just different ways of describing possession. And there's ample evidence that Colson possessed the stolen mail, and so therefore there's no sufficiency problem in this case as to the stolen mail. Now turning to the claim of insufficiency of principal liability as to identity theft in the second degree counts, the addition of the words or accomplice to count 7, which was the only count charging identity theft in the first degree, did not in any way change the elements of the other crimes. Accomplice liability is not an element, nor is it an alternative means, and adding that superfluous language to count 7 had no effect on what the state, the burden the state had of proving the other crimes. The law of the case doctrine, even if it was still alive and kicking, which I would argue it is not, wouldn't apply in this case to alter the sufficiency standard for those other crimes. The most it would do would say, well, because you've added or an accomplice to count 7, you have to meet that burden. But there's no question that we met the burden as to count 7. Moreover, as explained, I think, very well by Judge Dwyer in Tyler, Hickman is no longer good law in light of Musacchio. it's clear that this is sufficiency of evidence is a federal due process question. And Washington courts analyze it under the federal due process jurisprudence. And Musacchio clearly is controlling as to that federal due process analysis. Hickman, I think, is clearly just wrong. Hickman cites to civil cases from the 1880s for this law of the case doctrine. And the earliest criminal case that it cites to is Lehner in 1966, which sort of adopts this law of the case idea without any meaningful discussion whatsoever. There's absolutely no indication in the case law that this is based on any state constitutional principle. And as Judge Dwyer explained in Tyler, this is a federal due process question and needs to be analyzed consistently with the federal due process jurisprudence, because the courts, Washington courts, have never analyzed the state due process clause independently from the federal due process clause.
Tyler seems to mention Musacchio's discussion of due process in terms of the 14th Amendment. I think counsel suggesting Musacchio is really focused on the Fifth Amendment variety of due process. Is Musacchio clear?
Sure there's a difference. I mean, I think the due process is mentioned in both amendments, so I guess I'm not sure there's a difference.
Do you know if Musacchio expressly speaks to the 14th Amendment, mentions the 14th Amendment? As opposed to the Fifth?
I don't. So Musacchio, it's U.S. versus Musacchio, I believe, is the name of the case.
Right.
So that leads me to believe it was a federal prosecution. So they would be analyzing under the Fifth Amendment, because it's the 14th Amendment that applies due process to the states. But it's just it's an equivalency in my mind. So clearly the 14th Amendment applies the due process that would be due under the Fifth Amendment to the states. So I don't see that it would make a difference. The jury was properly instructed as to accomplice liability as to all counts in this case. There was overwhelming evidence that Chopra, Schultz, and Colson all knowingly participated and profited from all the crimes charged. This was clearly a joint enterprise, as argued by the jury. They were all criminally liable for the conduct of each other, and there was more than sufficient evidence on each of the counts here. This court has no further questions.
All right, thank you.
The jury has to be properly instructed on accomplice liability. When it's not properly instructed on accomplice liability, it may assume an additional burden. The state said nothing about State versus Willis. This is controlling precedent. It's analogous. This court is bound to follow it. It's stare decisis. The Supreme Court has said in State versus Gore, 101 Washington 2nd 401 from 1984, quote, once this court has decided an issue of state law, that interpretation is binding on all lower courts until it's overruled. Hickman and Willis have not been overruled. This court is bound to follow it, no matter what this court has said in Tyler or Johnson. Musacchio was a federal criminal case. It's interpreting the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment, which only applies to the federal government, does not apply to the states. It said nothing about the 14th Amendment. And even if it did say something about the 14th Amendment, the law of the case doctrine is based on Washington common law. So that means it doesn't affect the analysis.
Is there a nuanced difference between flavors of due process under the different amendments? Or?
Well, I mean, for example, there's no equal protection provision explicit for the federal government, so the U.S. Supreme Court has read that into the federal due process clause. I mean, they haven't done that in the 14th Amendment because there's an equal protection clause. So there is, an analytical difference.
Why is that a meaningful distinction, though?
It's a meaningful distinction because this court is bound to apply Washington Supreme Court precedent on state law until it's overruled. The federal court said nothing about state law, so Musacchio says nothing. So this court's bound to follow Hickman and Willis, and Musacchio really says nothing. And it's really up to the Washington Supreme Court to decide what it wants to do with Hickman and Willis. So applying the law of the case doctrine, regarding the issue of mail theft, I'd rest on my briefing on that case, or on that issue, but the main point I'd like to emphasize is my argument is that that statute is really analogous to the theft statutes, and the theft statutes there, even though there's a definitional section, the court has interpreted those definitions to be alternative means, and I think that's the proper analysis to follow as to interpreting the mail theft statute. So I'd ask this court to reverse all the Ms. Colson's convictions for insufficient evidence and dismiss with prejudice.
All right. Thank you.